So tonight I want to talk about souls. Souls as a concept, and maybe depending on your interest level, I could throw in a little bit of my own soul story, but I'm going to start out with souls. So let's just start. So we know that we're a soul before we're born, and we're a soul after we die. So we have to ask the question, why do we dip into this world, wear a physical body, and engage in a physical world for however long we get, 70 years, 90 years, 120 years, if we're that fortunate. But what's the point of this? So in order to understand what's the point of this body that I'm wearing, and it's interesting to think about our bodies, you know, before the rolling back the clock, before the first sin that Adam and Eve did, their bodies were light bodies. They were made out of ore, which is spelled with an aleph, that kind of light, right? Not really that kind of light, because it's a whole different kind of light. I had a teacher, Tila Yeager, who spoke to her children in Hebrew, and so I also spoke to my children in Hebrew just until they were three, because those are the conversations I could manage with a child. Once they started to ask me why airplanes stay in the sky, I had to answer in English. But get in the tub and get dressed, I could do that in Hebrew. So, but she told me that she would have a hard time identifying that for a toddler because she didn't want to call it ore, because ore is a really different concept than that, and yet that's what we call that. Meanwhile, after that first sin, we were given garments of skin, right? So you can think of, like, you could think of caveman pictures, right? Garments of skin, but really the garment of skin is this, right? We're totally transformed in our body, and we're then made out of ore, which is this, but spelled with an ayin. So we went from ore to ore. So we're wearing a very different type of a body, but that's a whole different type of a class also. But well, just to think about who we are and what we're, how we're engaging in the world. So we now have this heavy flesh body to deal with. But we started out as a soul. So we started out, and it talks about in the Gemara in Nida, it talks about how our souls are created as one and then torn in half, half sent into a male body, half sent into a female body. And then hopefully around 20 years-ish later, you find your soulmate, right? So Besheret is also a word that's used. So for purposes of this class, and it doesn't mean that it's always the case, there is a difference between Besheret and soulmate. So I'm just going to differentiate the vocabulary here. There are these two different concepts, but usually the terms are often used to mean the same thing. Soulmate, Besheret, Zivug. So take Besheret out. Zivug and soulmate, that concept, is the exact other half of your soul. Right? So if you imagine that soul torn in half, and then there's two halves that will fit together. The puzzle pieces fit. The jagged edges fit together. That's your soul mate. But there's, let's say, and I'm just picking a number just to illustrate. I'm not saying it's exactly like this. But there's probably 400 or so Besherets in the world. People where their jagged edges will match up just fine. It's not a perfect match, but it's just fine. And it turns out that under the chuppah, there is a spiritual transconfiguration that happens with those two soul halves of a Besheret, that's not a zivug, right, where they can match up just fine. In both cases, the chuppah is not what matches them up. It's actually the engagement of life with that person, engaging in the physical, that knits those two soul halves together. So we have the concept of the physical and the spiritual. So we have a world, physical and spiritual, and most religions recognize physical and spiritual and see them as on a continuum. And most religions also recognize that spiritual is the raison d'etre. Sorry, I'm in Europe, so I'm not saying it right. In America, that works without the right accent. It's the purpose of us being alive is to follow the spiritual. Most religions get that, and so they have some kind of a path, a system to seek spirituality, and that usually involves distancing oneself from physicality. But that's not the Jewish path. We don't see it as a continuum with physical on one side and spiritual on the other, and that the pathway is to distance. There's only one day a year, actually, that we do that. What day is that? Yom Kippur, where we don't do physical, so we can do spiritual, but whoever knows something about the Jewish holidays, what holiday is often spoken about as even holier than Yom Kippur? Purim. Purim, that's right. Purim, that most physical of all holidays, drinking and eating and parties and having a great time and costumes, right? It's so physical because the Jewish pathway is to engage in the physical to accomplish the spiritual. That's how we do it. So that's really what a mitzvah is. A mitzvah, how would you define mitzvah? Commandment. Also, anything else? It's the same root as the word for pliers because it connects two disparate ends. So mitzvah is a connector. But my translation for mitzvah is a physical act that achieves a spiritual goal. Right? It's something that we do physically to accomplish something spiritually. Because you might ask, so if we are spiritual beings having a physical experience, because really that's the essence of who we are. It's not that we're physical beings and occasionally we have a spiritual experience. Right? We're actually spiritual beings at our core. And right now we're having a physical experience. So the question is, how do we use this physical experience to accomplish what we're supposed to accomplish? And what are we supposed to accomplish anyway? So for a soul before we're born and we're a soul after we die, what are we supposed to do with this physical sojourn? What do you think? Come on. Mitzvahs, okay. Mitzvahs are the means to what goal? Come closer to God, okay. So we are supposed to come closer to God. Basically what we're supposed to do is exit differently than we entered. Right? But we don't want to just exit differently, because different could be lower, could be higher. Could be a little lower, could be a little higher. We want to exit very differently than we entered, hopefully much higher. And really, we want to come closer to God, because we want to be able to be in relationship with God so that God can fulfill His ultimate purpose in the creation of everything, which is to give us pleasure. That's what the deeper sources say. Pleasure. The whole world is created for pleasure. But what pleasure is it? It's not the pleasure of the here and now necessarily, although we are supposed to enjoy this world. But it's the pleasure of being in relationship with Hashem. The pleasure of Him giving Himself, basking in the glow of the Shekhinah. Whatever that means, and that's also a topic for a long discussion or multiple years of understanding, layers of that. But it really means basking in the glow of the relationship that you've created. This is the world for creating the relationship. That's the world for living in the relationship. So, and we see that just a little bit. There's a little allusion to it in the words that we use for this world, Aretz, and that world, Shemaim. This world, Aretz, roots. I'll run. I'm always in motion. Never get to sit still. I had a posek once who was constantly in motion. Alava Shalom, Rabbi Moshe Dov Stein. I think it happened a little sooner than he expected, but I asked him one day, I said, Rabbi, don't you ever get tired? He got up like 4:30 in the morning, gave a 5 o'clock shiur. He would fix the bungalow colonies here, he'd be doing the plumbing there, he'd give another shiur. Like he was on the go from like 5 till midnight or 1 every day. I said, he said, I'll catch up on sleep the first year I'm dead. So, because the world is about constant motion. Now, we should catch up our sleep and not wait till the first year we're dead. That's the truth. But we need to take care of our physical so that it doesn't get in the way of our spiritual. But there's all that energy in the physical, putting the time into the physical, but we have to figure out, so what are we trying to do? We want to be in the relationship to receive pleasure, and the receiving pleasure is all about experiencing the relationship. So again, for a longer talk, let's just talk about souls then, how they actually work for a minute. So souls have 5 levels, or one way of understanding them. I have learned now in Jewish education and thought never to say the, not the answer and not the way, a way, an answer, right? So a way of understanding souls. There's many different ways, but a principal way of understanding souls that's spoken about regularly is in this 5-level construct. So we have 5 levels. It's a little confusing. So anybody who's writing, draw yourself a little diagram. So think about links in a chain, right? So 5 circles that touch each other, that are interlinked with each other. So just imagine links in a chain. Those 5 links, which I'll name in a minute, the whole thing all together is called neshama. Right? So when we talk about our neshama, that's what we're talking about. And the first place that we see a word that has to do with neshama is when Hashem blows the soul into us. And the word is nishima, right? It's from breath, right? It's from breath. So Hashem blows the soul into us. And a classic illusion is like the glass blower, where He creates a shape but blows into the shape, uses His breath. So that the breath is part of the person, but not part of the person, that our soul is part of Hashem, but not part of Hashem, like our breath is part of us, but not part of us, can be separate once it exits us, but is part of us once it's in us. So our soul is sort of like that, not Hashem, but started there, was blown out, and somehow separated. I can't understand that, but I'm just saying that's how it initially worked, okay? So that whole thing is called neshama. Now to get confusing, each one has its own name. And the middle one is called neshama. But the whole thing is also called neshama. So the bottom is nefesh, then comes ruach, then comes neshama, then comes chaya, and then comes yechida. Nefesh, that bottom level, nefesh is related to the word that means rest. A nofesh in modern Hebrew is a vacation. So that's the part of the soul that rests up against the body, so to speak. That part that like touches us as if it could. It can't because it's spiritual, but if it could, it's that part that touches us. So that's the nefesh. Then skipping the second level for a second, the third level is neshama. Neshama is that part of our soul that yearns, that seeks to identify with the Creator, to be in communion with Hashem. And we can feel into that level. We can sense the neshama level that does seek altruism, that seeks connection with the divine, that wants to go, wants to soar. That's the neshama level. Ruach, the second level, means wind. It also means spirit. But here, wind. Wind is something that's unstable, that goes back and forth, that blows around, and it mediates between those two. So it mediates between that part that rests up against you and that part that desires to be so high. Those are the three. If you have questions, you can ask. Stop me at any time. So those are the three layers that are on the bottom rung. After that comes Chaya and Yechida. Chaya and Yechida are layers that we don't feel into. Usually even very, very spiritually astute people don't feel into those levels. I'm sure somebody on the planet does. But in general, they're not parts of our soul that we are conscious of, but they still affect us. So those are the parts of the soul that loosen their bonds with the rest of it and can soar while we're sleeping, can go to different places. It says in the Gemara that sleep is like 1/60th of death. So what's 1/60th? Is it exactly 1/60th? Are we exactly 1/60th dead? So 1/60th is a measurement that's used in halacha and here in hashkafa to explain a measurement that's big, but not big enough to necessarily be felt. Right? So it's there. 1/60th you could point out, but you can't taste it. So that's a measurement that we use in kashrut. Right? If you have on the stove, right? You're making chicken soup for Shabbos. Does it snow here? Well, just let's pretend we're in Denver, okay? So it's a snowy day, so your kids are out playing and you're making chicken soup. And right here, you're making hot chocolate, right? So and you're stirring the hot chocolate for the kids when they come in from outside, and the chicken soup's right here. And they come in from outside and you're stirring the hot chocolate. You spin around to see the kids and your hot chocolate drips into your chicken soup, right? Kosher or treif? Kosher, right? Because less than a few drops went in there. Even though actual real milk went in there, even if you would forget and stir with that whole milky spoon with cup dripping in hot chocolate in your big pot of chicken soup, it would still be kosher. The spoon would be treif, but the soup would be kosher.
As long as it wasn't on purpose.
As long as it wasn't on purpose, right. You got surprised. The kids came in there. Not because you want that little bit of flavor. That doesn't count. But if you didn't, it was by mistake, and you got a few drops in, it's under 1/60th, it is kosher. So, and we also say that when we visit sick people, we take away 1/60th of their illness. Right? So that, and the measurement is, it's actually something real. You go visit somebody who's sick, you do take, you lift off of them 1/60th of their illness. But do they look better when you leave? Not really. They might, depending. But really, it is something real, but maybe not huge.
Sorry. It doesn't mean if 60 people went at the same time.
That would be good. I don't think it usually works that way. I think it's like always a 60th, and then, yeah. Yeah. Right. So I don't know if it would work if all 60 went at once, but you know, it'd be interesting to try. Certainly.
It's the 60th. Exponentially. 60th, 59, 60th, and then 60th.
It is, right.
58, 60.
Right, but if 60 came all at once, would it be a...
The patient would die.
Well, anyway, it's the same thing with the souls leaving us when we sleep. So the definition of death is when the soul leaves the body, right? There are two parts of creation, spiritual parts and physical parts, right? So physical is this world and the heavens, meaning all the stars and celestial bodies, this world, all the plants, all the animals, the people, this is physical. And then the spiritual part of creation is all the forces, the angelic forces, there are some negative forces too, but all of that is spiritual. We are the only creatures that have both in us. Only by miracle can we have that. That's one reason why we say umaflila asot at the end of a Shir Yetzar. The Hashem does miracles. Thank you. I warned Ruthie to warn me. Thank you. After we go to the bathroom, there's a special blessing that we say that thanks God for forming our bodies with wisdom. And at the end of it, we say, thank you, Hashem, for, and it depends on how you translate it. Mafli la asot. Well, one way of translating those words is doing wonders with me, right? Doing wonders in me. You do wonders. And so one of the things that it refers to is the wonder of soul and body staying together. Because really they shouldn't. One's purely spiritual, one's purely physical. They're only bound together by miracle. So, okay, why did I go there? Now I have to remember what I was about to say. Right. Okay. So then we're in that body. I just lost my train of thought. Somebody's supposed to remind me now. Oh, thank you. Okay, good. Okay. So those upper levels then. Right. Thank you. So 1/60th dead when we sleep, because the definition of death is when the soul leaves the body. Thank you. And then we can have but it leaves us partially while we're sleeping. A part of our soul partially leaves us while we're sleeping. So we are considered 1/60th dead when we sleep. So it's the Chaya and Yechida that can go. Now the Chaya and Yechida can go to different realms in the spiritual world, learn different things, see different things, and bring it back to us. But how do they get there? How do they have access to different realms in the spiritual world? So basically there's two aspects that I'm aware of at this point in my understanding. It's all dependent on what we do, but they need sort of a passport, so they need entrance. They need to be permitted entrance to certain spiritual realms. That's one thing they need. And they also need, imagine they're sort of like kites on a string. They're still connected to our soul, but they can go far. So the length of the string also dictates where they could go. So it might have enough length of string that it could knock on a certain door, so to speak, but not have the passport to enter there, right? And it might have a passport, but not the length of string. So it's really the ability to travel and the permission to enter certain realms. It needs both. And so that ability and the permission comes from the way that we behaved during the day. And so that directly impacts on where the soul can go that night. So as it travels, it's able to learn certain things and have access to certain realms. And then what happens is when it comes back, that whatever the energy is that comes from that filters down through the Chida. It might be from the Chaya level, depending on which one got it. It filters down through the Neshama into the Ruach, into the Nefesh. And now let's get even more confusing. Into the lower Nefesh, into the consciousness, into the imagination, into dreams, into us. So let's just go for a second with the lower nefesh. Okay, so this makes it a little bit more confusing, but how is that neshama connected to us? And does anything else have a neshama? So we talked about how human beings are the only ones that have that blend of the physical and the spiritual. And yet we see in some animals, it sure looks like they have emotions, they have curiosity, they feel connected to us. Does anybody have pets in this room? Now or in the past? Yeah, you do now. What do you have?
Cat.
A cat, okay. Anybody ever had a dog?
Dogs and cats.
Dogs and cats. Who else? Yeah?
Dog.
Anybody ever have or have a brother that had snakes, frogs, fish?
Yeah, fish?
Fish, okay, so... fish and cats, let's say, right? Which is cuddlier? right? So if you look at a fish's face, like, they're not that excited when you come in the room. They do swim to the top of the tank. They know they're going to get fed. But they don't necessarily greet you with joy. A cat doesn't always either. But dogs do always. I'm a dog person. So I'm sure cats can be friendly too. But dogs always come and greet you, right? So you wonder, like, when our dog got hit by a car and had to be put to sleep because he broke his pelvis, it was so sad. So the vet sent us a condolence card. I didn't cry as much from the whole death as I did from the condolence card. Forget it. The condolence card talked about the Rainbow Bridge and how the dog has crossed over the Rainbow Bridge and he's frolicking happily in green meadows and pastures and is going to wait there faithfully for the time when I cross the Rainbow Bridge and is going to be there to greet me and we'll be together forever. And I was like sobbing and sobbing even though I didn't believe a word of it. I'm like, oh, the Rainbow Bridge, I'm going to see honey again. So, all right, so dogs don't have neshamas, but they do have, and cats too, but they do have a nefesh. A nefesh is an animating life force. Now, when I say nefesh here, I don't mean the bottom level of our soul. I mean the animating life force that makes all living things alive. The neshama, those five layers of the neshama, the bottom of which is also called the nefesh, is connected to us through the nefesh, our animal life force. It's in the nefesh, the animal life force that we share with other animals, meaning that we have similar nefeshes. That's where curiosity is. That's where loyalty can be. Loyalty can be in the neshama too. But a basic loyalty, like a dog or a cat has for an owner. The emotions, the base emotions, which can be pretty broad, like what you would see in a dog or a cat. Those types of embarrassment, jealousy, can all be in the nefesh, that lower animal level. This is all according to the Ramchal and Derech Hashem, in case anybody's wondering where this information is from. This is straight up Ramchal. Anyway, so that's Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto in The Way of God, if anybody wants to look up the book. Anyway, so we have that the basic animal soul, and the animal soul is then connected to us through the blood, which is one reason why we don't take in blood of any other creature, because that is considered the life force. So it's in the blood that the nefesh is connected. So when the blood drains, the nefesh has nothing to connect to. And so that's one reason why lack of blood means death, right? Then the nefesh leaves. So it's really the nefesh that's the animating life force and the neshama that is the humanizing life energy that comes in after that. So I'm not sure when the nefesh attaches to the body, if that's at conception or not, but Jewishly we understand that the neshama comes in at 40 days after conception. So, you know, all different religions argue about when life starts, when is the fetus viable, right? So what's the Jewish definition, official definition of when the fetus is viable? When they graduate med school. So, pardon? When it starts to beat. So I think it's really, we our definition, and we do have different halachic things that happen with 40 days of conception before and after. Right, so there is some halachic room for abortion. We should never need it before 40 days, much less, but certainly to save a mother's life after. But that is a dividing point, that 40 days when the soul comes in. It's interesting to know now that our scientific research at this point shows that at 40 days is when the gender is differentiated, that basically they're undifferentiated blobs at first, and at 40 days there's a hormone wash that makes them male or female. So who knows if that's connected, but it could be because it seems like the soul is probably male or female and there is that differentiation that happens at that stage. Okay, so the soul comes in and then the question is, how do we get the soul to be different? It comes into us in all those five layers and it can go to different realms while we're sleeping. It comes back into us when we wake up. That's why we're so careful with washing our hands in the morning. Anybody who has that practice and anybody who doesn't might want to consider it. That's a very important time to wash hands because you're actually washing off a very special kind of spiritual ritual impurity at that point because we were 1/60th dead. So death is lack of potential. Life is potential, and death is lack of potential. So no potential is our greatest source of tumah, of spiritual disconnectivity. And total potential is our greatest source of tahara, spiritual connectivity. Right? So we had, even though our neshama was gaining insights and whatever it got up there, hopefully, still it was less connected to our body, and so there was a drop of less life potential in us at that time. We can't really move volitionally when we're sleeping. We're really sleeping deeply and our soul is really in another place. There is something that holds us back. So that loss of life energy that happens at night, when our soul comes back in, there is a leftover tuma that's on our body. And it's really two layers also. So there's the amount of tuma that's there from our soul leaving, the amount of ritual impurity that's there from the soul's exit, and then it returns, so but it's there from the exit. And then also nighttime, I hope I'm not going too deep or a little scary. Nighttime is a time where the negative forces have the ability to reign. So we understand that nighttime is not a time for really anything except for sleeping or learning Torah. It's not how we practice today, but in general, we're supposed to be very careful at night. Not only can't we see so well, so it's more dangerous, but it's we don't see so well because it is more dangerous, meaning it's a more dangerous time. We're more vulnerable to negative spiritual energies. And according to what we have done during the day, we, in a way, create a force field around us of positivity or a thinner or thicker force field of the positive things that we've done in the day. So depending on how much positivity we've engaged in or how we may have dissipated that energy force by negative things that we've engaged in, we're more or less vulnerable to negative energies at night. And especially when our soul leaves us, then we have less protection there too. So there's external protection and internal protection, and they both kind of go a little bit at night. Anyway, it all comes together when we wake up. By divine decree, it all settles in our fingertips, all the negative leftover energy. So in the morning, when we get up, we wash our hands the same way we do when we leave a cemetery, because there is a little bit of that death energy on us. So we pick up the cup with the right hand, fill it up all the way, transfer it to the left, and then depending on your custom, either three or four times on each side to take the negativity away. But that washing is such an important washing, and the water that comes off is such a negative water that today we don't think about it, it just goes right down the drain. But back in the olden days when you'd have to draw water, and you were very careful with the water that you drew, and you would recycle it if you possibly could, you can't recycle that water. It can't be used for feeding pets or watering plants or anything else, or a second wash, nothing else. It's only for that. So it's an interesting thing. Anybody who wants to take that on, so it's an important washing to do in the morning, more important than other washings. Okay, so now the question is, how do we get our souls to change? Right? So fortunately, we don't have to guess. Fortunately, Hashem clued us in on this. So he gave us a whole system of physical pathways to affect our spiritual selves. And that's the mitzvah system. So we have positive commandments and negative commandments. That's the two categories. It's one or the other. So the positive commandments are basically grow your soul this way. And the negative commandments are don't diminish your soul this way. So that we could know that whatever physical thing we do, we engage in one of those pathways, either soul growth or soul diminishment. It's not possible to do anything physical that doesn't do one or the other. There is no parav act, no neutral act, right? It's sort of like, let's say, I regularly use being on a diet, right? So I want to lose weight, right? So does one M&M make a difference in my efforts? Just one. Does it? It does, right? One does. Not a big difference, a little difference. But it does make a difference. Right? I'm looking at that whole table and somebody said, oh, this is good and that's good. She said, I give you a little bit of everything. I was like, oh, it looks so good. No, nothing, because I have a goal, right? And it doesn't include that. So even though it all looks great, right, I have to remind myself. And I did succumb today, and Hashem helped me, rescued me totally. I went into the bakery to buy something to take on the plane, and I said, do you take credit cards? She said, nope, just cash. I was like, whew. I don't have any English cash. I just have a credit card. Thank you, Hashem. You rescued me. I almost really succumbed, you know. So I didn't. Well, he took care of me. So anyway, one M&M makes a difference. And so does one extra rep. If you're in the gym and you're lifting weights, which I don't, right? But let's say you're walking around the lake, which I do, right? So one extra step. Does it make a difference? It does. One. Just it's one extra calorie or whatever it is, but it's that much closer to your goal, right? So there are things that bring you much closer or much further or a little closer, a little further, but there's nothing that doesn't do something. So spiritually, that's what it is. Whatever we do physically has an impact on our soul, a little or a lot or a medium, depending on what the thing is. But it all has an impact. It's not possible to engage in the physical world without impacting your soul, because that's the way Hashem set it up, that as we engage in the physical, we affect the spiritual. So he gave us a system. Engage this way, you for sure will affect it positively. Engage in this way, you for sure will affect it negatively. There is some middle ground where we're not quite sure, where we do have to figure it out, but we will be affecting. You can't do something physical without affecting. That's for sure. That's also straight up Ramchal. Okay, so we are affecting. So now the question is, how do we do what we want to do? So by engaging in mitzvahs, we can transform our soul. So the trick is to transform ourselves to become as much like Hashem as we possibly can be. Because the more like God we can be, the more in relationship we can be. The stronger relationship we have, the more God can give God's self to us. If you think about your own relationships, from lightweight friendships, acquaintanceships, to friendships, to close friendships, to best friendships, to marriages, to excellent marriages, right? Because not all marriages are great. So marriage, good marriage, great marriage, right? There's a continuum of relationships, peer-based relationships. So within that continuum, there's different levels of how much you can give yourself to another in that relationship. So a fabulous marriage, one in which the couple has really been working over the years to become one, that's where they can give the most to each other. And that's really what we're trying to create here, is a fabulous marriage, in essence, with Hashem. Except for how do we behave towards Hashem like we would towards a close friend or a spouse? You know, we know what our friend likes, a good friend, how they like their tea, how much sugar, what kind they like, caffeinated, decaf, what cup they like. Do they like a small cup, a big cup, a wide English cup, a tall cup, an insulated cup? They don't drink it so much. You know, we know all that stuff. And it's an act of love when we give it to our friend that way, right? So how do we give tea to Hashem, right? We don't know, but he clued us in. So we have a whole system. Now, what if we don't really understand the system? So there's a thing, what I call spiritual pharmacology, right? So everybody knows, well, I don't know, in this country, what do you take for headaches in this country?
Norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine, okay. Acetaminophen, right? Right. So in America, it's Advil or Tylenol, right? You know that you take that, right? So one day, one of my kids bumped their toe and they were in pain. And I said, take some Advil. And I said, that works on toes too, right? So we all know, of course it works on toes too, because it doesn't go to your head and make your head feel better or to your toe. It works in your head to block pain, right? It's a pain blocker. So we know how that works. So we're able to use it and apply it in different ways. And we know how some other drugs work. We know what to take for allergies and what to take for upset stomachs. And we all are smart enough that we could know how all the drugs work if we wanted to. But we don't. So if we're really sick and we don't know how to use whatever we have in the house, we go to somebody who's studied how all that works and we trust them. In general, we find somebody, hopefully, that we trust. And then when they say, take X, we know to take it. Now, right after we got married, we wanted to start our marriage off with a mitzvah because we weren't going to make aliyah at that time and we weren't studying in kollel. And I just felt like we have to start with something strong and positive. It was 1985, so and I was very involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, so we went to Russia. So we got to Russia, and, you know, in Kiev, yeah, I think in Kiev, maybe it was in Leningrad. Anyway, I got a terrible stomach bug, and I'm throwing up, and it's coming out, you know, every orifice. I'm not doing well at all, right? And we're newly married, right? So my husband's like, I'm going to get you a doctor. I'm like, don't get me a doctor. I had lived in Israel for 4 years. I knew I did not want to see a Russian doctor. They all have gold teeth, and they're fat ladies. I'm not interested at all, right? So did not want a Russian doctor. But he's like, oh, I'm getting you a doctor. His new wife, you know, she's sick, and off he runs. The hotel has a doctor. They come for free. The doctor came, wrote me out a list of prescriptions. He took the list of prescriptions. He had to go to 3 different pharmacies. He filled the prescriptions. He brings them back to me. Gives me these pills, like, from India. I'm like, I'm not taking these. I'm not using the water from the hotel to drink. I'm not swallowing them. I'm not putting it into my body. There's no way I'm taking this. You know, I'd rather just be sick for a few days and take my chances. I'm not taking Russian or Indian medicine. That's not happening. So you have to have somebody that you trust. That's the point. A medical practitioner that you work well with, that you trust, because they understand your body and how things work in it. So, but you don't have to understand how it works for it to work for you, right? If you have a friend who does understand, right? Advil, right? Advil works on cramps too. Why? Because it's a muscle relaxant. You might not know that. You take it for headaches, but if you have terrible cramps and your friend says, try Advil, it'll help even if you don't know how it works, right? So you don't have to understand how it works for it to work. And the same thing with mitzvahs. There is a spiritual pharmacology there. It's possible for all of us to learn enough that we would know exactly how it works. But even if we don't know, it still works. All you have to do is swallow it. I'm not saying you have to swallow the whole system. You have to swallow the mitzvah, engage in it in the way it needs to be engaged in, and it works, no matter if you understand it or not. The more you understand, the more you can manipulate your environment to make it work in different ways, just like nutrition, right? You could either follow a diet or you could learn how nutrition works. And then you can make your own decisions. So all of that information is available to us. We can make it work. Okay, so any questions up to here? Let me just pause for a minute.
Just one question. I remember learning that Ruach is actually more than giving a direction. It's more connected with the intellect, which you describe as the lower part of the neshama, then of the nefesh, which is connected to our consciousness. So I wonder how you...
I probably don't know enough of that construct to explain it. So you're saying Ruach has more collected intellect and...
It works in that paradigm that you have presented, the construct, and that Ruach that is more related to the rationale and the intelligence in us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'll have to learn more about it.
So that when one learns Torah, so that taps into...
So it's the Ruach that's working on the Torah as opposed to the nefesh? Good. I'd like more information on that. If you want to show me a source later, I'd appreciate integrating more information for sure. Okay. Right. Now, let me ask you this. So we understand that Jews and non-Jews have different souls, right? Is that an understanding that most people share? Jews and non-Jews have different souls, that this soul is different. I think, but I'm not positive, that non-Jews have the same structure, but it's such a different type of a soul that it's actually considered a different species spiritually. So it's interesting to think about where our body shapes actually do reflect a little bit of our soul. In ancient days, it reflected much more. So Avraham and Yitzchak, for instance, looked the same. Avraham actually asked for aging to exist so that it would be possible to tell the difference between him and his son. So that was his request, that aging should exist. So you could tell the difference between older and younger, but they looked so much the same. And one reason why they look the same, Rav Dessler explains, is that the mission of the soul is perfectly matched with the physical container of the soul. So people with a similar mission will have a similarly shaped physical container. So not only do we have individual souls, but we do have, there's a thing which I don't know that much about, family souls also. So there is such a thing as a soul that a transgenerational soul, in a sense, where family members do look similar to each other. And not only do they inherit their stuff, but they inherit their stuff, right? Their baggage too, right? So, but that's because we need both the stuff and the stuff to continue the mission of the family soul. That each generation has an opportunity to add its piece to working out the family issues, hopefully. Okay, that being said, let's just go a little bit more complicated. So we made a nice, easy construct of soulmate, right? So a nice, easy construct of one, the concept of one soul, which was divided into that one soul in this easier construct is created as one because we're created in the image of Hashem. And we know that one of the things we know about Hashem is that Hashem is one, right? So we had to be created in that image. For various reasons, we needed to be divided in half and then work on knitting it back together to emulate Hashem, becoming one again, right? So we have that concept. Let's make it more complicated now, because some of the questions that I typically get are, okay, so if I have one soulmate and we believe in reincarnation, which does happen, not everybody, not all Chachamim believe that reincarnation is a thing, but it's strong enough. There's a machloket, there's an argument within Jewish streams of thought, but it's a strong enough thought that we can talk that about it existing, although not everybody agrees. But let's say it does, within the paradigm of reincarnation existing. It A, only exists for those who need it and those who deserve it, both. Right? So you have to have messed up enough in life that you have to come back, that you need to come back, and done enough right in life that you get to come back, right? Both together. So you have to have made enough mistakes that your soul is not finished enough that it needs to come back to finish its job. But if you made so many mistakes that you just completely blew it, you don't get a second chance. You only get a second chance, or maybe a third chance, you only get another chance if you deserve it, if you did enough good that it's worth it to reincarnate you. Right, so it has to be both. You need it and you deserve it, both together to make it happen. So we're not at all like the Buddhists where it's just one after another. That's not us at all. It's only special circumstances.
When you say reincarnate,
can you Tchias HaMesim? Nope. Tchias HaMesim is resurrection. Reincarnation is Gilgulim, right, where souls go from one body to another body to another body or is reborn. In this is it's from carnate, right, from carne, flesh. It's re fleshified, right? It goes, we had President Bush, so we can make these kinds of, I don't know, if you know, President Bush had all kinds of weird words. So
I don't know if it's connected to what you're talking about, but you know when somebody passes away and you dream about them,
mm-hmm.
and for a while you don't dream about them, is it possible that their neshama has gone?
Yes.
To somebody else's body?
Oh, it could go to somebody else's body, possibly, or also to too high a level for it to easily come back and communicate. Because there are different levels of neshamic disengagement.
Yeah.
Right? So right after death, it hovers around in the Shiva home. It's right there.
Yeah.
Right? So I learned that once when I paid a Shiva call to somebody who was sitting Shiva alone. Right? So I do speak Hebrew. So I said, Hashem yinachem otach. B'toch shar of Leitzi and Yerushalayim, right? And she said, oh, no, you can't say it in the singular. You still have to say it in the plural because you're comforting me and the neshama of the deceased. The neshama of the deceased is in the Shiva home and is also being comforted on the separation. It's difficult for the neshama, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the first 7 days. And then it does shift up a level but still is around for the first 30 days. Still closer by. It's sort of like cell phone reception bars, right? So you still have like almost 5 bars in Shiva, maybe 4 for the Shloshim, and they start to disappear as the soul gets its elevations. So we often say, may his soul have an aliyah. May the soul be elevated through this act, right? Whatever it is, some in Sephardic circles, they make a suda, they make a meal, so that everybody will be saying blessings, and those blessings elevate the soul. Or you learn, or you give tzedakah. Things help bring the soul up and up and up, and sometimes it goes up high enough that it can no longer be in contact.
Not at all, or if the contact becomes...
Very difficult rare. And very rare. Very rare.
And when it doesn't happen at all, does it mean that it's gone to somebody else's body?
I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know, but I'm going to make it more complicated in just a minute, yeah? It seems that the reception is much better. So in using the cell phone metaphor, so that's a cell phone tower right there at the kever. At the grave. The grave is actually a place where reception is the strongest. So where there might be connection somewhere else, there's a very strong connection right at the grave. So the physical presence of you at the grave with the receptor site, whatever spiritual connectivity is there at the grave, it's the strongest connectivity that we can access to that person's soul. So their soul isn't there, but the connection is the strong, access is the stronger at the grave. Excellent question. Right. All complications, right? So let me point this out. This is important to understand. Very important to understand. Yes. Good. So ask me that in just a second. Okay. I don't know. But I'll get to some details of that. But first I want to say this. The Rambam says very clearly that we do not have to hold one opinion in philosophy. Right? So in Jewish philosophic thought, there is no one right way. There is one truth, ultimately. But the Rambam explains very clearly, I'm pretty sure it's in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, but I'm not positive. I'll have to look it back up. That there are many different ways of thinking, and you don't have to pick one. You can live in question. So what does that mean, to live with a question? So I want to talk about that, too. So who was there on Shabbos? Anybody here on Shabbos? I hate to repeat myself, but I will anyway, in case anybody was there for Shabbos. Okay, so what do we have on the Seder table? We have the Kos Eliyahu in the middle. Right? I don't know if you guys have this song, but my kids sing, "Don't shake the table, don't shake the table, watch that cup of wine, because I want to see the wine goes down when it's Eliyahu's time." Right? So everybody thinks Eliyahu comes and drinks from the cup, but he doesn't. So when I tried telling my daughter-in-law from a Hasidish family, right, that Eliyahu, it's called the Kos Eliyahu, not because he comes to drink. I couldn't even say "but," right? She's like, "You're ruining my childhood. You're ruining my childhood." I'm like, "No, I'm going to tell you why it's called that. It's not because he comes to drink from it, okay? It's because there's lots of questions out there. And when Eliyahu comes, before the Mashiach comes, Eliyahu is going to come and answer questions. We have lots of questions. That cup in the middle of the table is one big question mark. Because there are actually five languages of redemption. V'hotzeti, v'hitzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti, v'heveti. V'heveti, right? There's five languages of redemption. I can't do that in English. I'm sorry. Took me out and rescued me, redeemed me, saved me, and brought me into the land. We pour four cups and drink four cups because of the four languages of redemption that happened. They all have to do with coming out of Egypt. But the fifth one, "you brought me into the land," it's not about the first time bringing us into the land. It's about the last time bringing us into the land, right? So we're not quite there yet. We started a trickle, but we're not there yet. So the question is, what do we do with that cup? What do we do with that word? Do we drink that cup or not? So the answer is, we pour it, but we don't drink it. It's called Kos Eliyahu because it's a question mark. And it will be answered when he comes and answers questions. So it's a big, giant question mark right in the middle of the Seder table. That's what it is. And we live with the question, and it's fine.
But it's also because Eliyahu, because there were, that's our final galut, but there were redemptions before, because Eliyahu is believed to be present in every generation.
Yes, he is, but it's not for him. We don't, you know, some people said a place at the table, all right, and at a bris, certainly there's, we're not pouring the cup for him to come drink it. That's childhood lore. Right, and that's commonly believed, but that's not the case. It's called Kos Eliyahu because he is going to tell us, do we drink it or not? What do we do with that? Right, so that's why it's called that. So, but the point is, it's a question, and it's okay because it's a philosophic question. We can live with that. Yeah.
You mentioned that the soul of a non-Jew and a Jew is very different. So how do you explain a ger, a convert?
Okay, we're going to get there. What a great question.
You know, I have a lot of friends who, funnily enough, were raised as, it's normally those who are very strong in the Christian faith, part of the church, like Mormons, evangelicals, and a lot of them have converted, and I wouldn't say they're frumma, but yeah. That they become frumma than the frumma. So
it does.
It's so different. I don't understand. It's
right.
Some sort of change.
Yes.
What brings those people to Judaism? I mean,
Good. We are so going to go there. But hang on one second. So I don't know how many times you can be reincarnated. I just want to hold your question and bring me right back there for one second. I just want to tell you there's one more very complicated thing about souls. And so this is my own language, but I call it soul chips. So it turns out that there's not one soul that gets divided in half and half goes into a girl and half goes into a boy, and we don't have perfect soulmates, right? We do have a concept that we're all connected to each other. We are all connected to each other. So we have a concept of 600,000 souls that were at Mount Sinai, and yet we know that there were 3 million people at Mount Sinai. 600,000 Jewish souls doesn't really work out in terms of the math. There's more than 600,000 Jews alive right now, and if you count from the first moment of Jewish history until the end of the world, right, there's going to be way more than 600,000 Jews. So how does it work with our souls, right? Do we just splinter them all and we get one splinter each? Maybe, but I think it's even actually much more complicated than that. I think that my understanding at this point, and it's just at this point in my development, understandingly, right, take 600,000, divide it by the amount of Jews that ever were and ever will be. So add up that number, whatever that is. Let's just say, and this is just, let's just say, you multiply that number by 10, okay? So you have that number divided into 600,000. That's soul splinters, right? Then we all have stacks of soul splinters. That's really the neshama that we're carrying, each one of us. Some people might have 3 splinters. Some people might have 15. Some people might have 10. And let's say I have 10 right now. One might be from my grandmother. One might be from Miriam, Moshe's sister. One might be from, I don't know, from who, like different, and stacked up in different ways. And then when I get reincarnated, it's not this stack of 10. It could be splintered up and only pieces can go. So it's much, much, I just want to say that just so it's, that's not the exact construct. It's just you should know it's much more complicated than what we're talking about, right? And I can't help you there. I'm teaching you what I know and it's not that much. Yeah. Pardon?
What is the source of that?
The fact that there's 600,000 souls and there's so many more people.
No.
So conversations with
right.
I don't have a source. I have conversations with different rabbis about it, and it's just put together. So I'm still working on that. I haven't seen something like that inside a source. But we know that there's a concept of 600,000, and we know that there's many more Jews, and we know that we have concepts of reincarnation. So we just have to know at least. So I'm not saying this construct is 100% true. I'm just saying that something like this is because it's much more complicated than that. Right now, that being said, we're really one soul. So, and it seems like we're all separate, but we're not. It's sort of like a mum plant. Have you ever seen a mum plant or planted that in your yard? So I, as a new bride, saw mum plants, and I thought, oh, they're so beautiful and bushy. I'm going to take it home. I'll just have to buy one. I'll divide it into 4, right, and plant it, and it'll have room to grow. Bring it home. Go down to the bottom of it. Divide it. It's one stick at the bottom and 300 blossoms. Right? So, but there's no dividing that. It's not like another pot where you can like tear apart the roots at all. It's one stick at the bottom and then a bushy thing with tons of blossoms. And that's really what the Jewish people are, and ultimately all humanity, but let's not go there yet, just the Jewish people, right? Is that we're all different blossoms. We manifest in different ways, but really we're all one at the root. So we look different because skin separates us one from another. But the truth is, we're all one. So what we do affects all of us. There is no doing something that doesn't affect our partner, our neighbor. Ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. The word re'a, translated here as neighbor, doesn't mean neighbor who lives next door to you. Re'a means broken piece of you, like trua. Right? True. And the shofar is the staccato note in the shofar. It's the broken piece one. Right? So Rea is the broken piece of you. Right? Love your broken piece like you love yourself, because that broken piece is you. Right? We are all one. Now, how do non-Jews become Jews? So this happens to be one of my areas of interest because I used to be not Jewish and now I'm Jewish. So I'll tell you about the process, right? This is how it works. First of all, we said that the physical body does have something to do with the spiritual essence of the person. And so you would think that if our souls are different species, our bodies should be differently shaped. And in fact, when what's her name? Ahuva Gray. Does anybody know who she is? She's a black Gioret. So when she converted, she was in Israel for several years. And the day that she went to the mikvah, she came back from the mikvah, fully Jewish, to one of the families that took loving care of her. And one of the children said, I thought Ahuva was converting today. And the mother said, she did. She said, why is she still black? So it turns out that we are shaped the same as non-Jews so that you won't be able to see the miraculous transition that takes place in the mikvah. If we would actually enter the mikvah in one body shape and exit it a different body shape, enter non-Jewish and exit Jewish, and the body would be shaped differently, it would be an open miracle and it would get in the way of free choice. So it can't. So we have to be shaped physically the same way so that you can't tell. And so that we can blend, so we have also the option to assimilate if we want to, that we shouldn't, but we could. We can disappear into the nations. If you think about it, we are small in number, but we must be huge in number. Because being Jewish is not dependent at all on what you believe or think. Right? It's just on, do you have a Jewish mother? Or did you convert according to halacha? Right? So if you have a Jewish mother, you're Jewish no matter what you think. So think about those 10 lost tribes, right? We all come from either choice or the two tribes that were left over. So if you take the 14 million Jews-ish that are 14 million-ish Jews that are here today, really you could multiply that by quite a few and thinking about the descendants from the 10 lost tribes, right? There's lots of Jews on this planet. We don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. Right? But they're there. So one reason for the body shape being the same is so that they can be everywhere and they don't even know. Right? It's not necessarily about that. Okay, so how's the transition made? Did you have a question first?
I have a question, but I didn't want to interrupt your play.
Okay. So I'll hold the question and maybe yours will go in. Okay, go. Ask your question.
Basically, I got into a whole argument last week with someone who believes that his mission in life is to educate people who he calls half Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So, because he thinks that after the Holocaust there's so few in number and we weren't lost, and we have to accept everyone who's even father is Jewish. And I was trying to explain to him from my understanding, as far as I know, that I think there's nothing...
Right, so you're the Jewish, or you're not. You can't be half pregnant, you can't
right.
be half Jewish.
So that's what I was saying.
Right.
That's not always been the case, and if you go back far enough, you used to be able to be Jewish through your father as well. So I was trying to look into sources. And
no, so
why
from...
Is the Neshama passed through the mother, and why would that be?
Isn't that interesting?
It is very interesting.
Yeah, it is passed
really
through the mother. Right, right. It is passed through the mother. Some of that is the root of Emunah, even though it's not dependent on Emunah, but Aim, mother, is the root of Emunah, right? So that it's she that passes that.
I can understand that totally from a psychological perspective.
Right, but why? That's the halacha.
It's like a physical manifestation.
Right, that's the halacha. It only goes into a Jewish woman. That's the only place it can be hosted is in a Jewish woman. So it turns out that we are close enough physically that we can crossbreed. The species can crossbreed. The spiritual species of Jews and non-Jews can interbreed. So they can produce a human child. And it just so then it depends on whether, depending on the mother or the father. So there is a difference. A Gentile with a Jewish father is still a Gentile. But they are in a separate halachic category. They're called Zera Yisrael, the seed of a Jew. They're still a Gentile, but the seed of a Jew. So the difference of that category of Gentile is if they come to convert, we accept them right away. Because we understand that there's something inside them, in their blood, that's drawing them to Judaism. So we don't push them away at all. We don't raise the bar for them. We bring them in. We do our best to bring them in. According to Jewish law, they're still a Gentile. They still have to go through the whole process. But we don't push them away. And others we do push away first. Yeah.
I have two questions. One, I was also taught that it used to go by the father, and then it switched. So how does that work then?
My understanding is that from Sinai, it went through the mother. And before Sinai, it really went by choice. So you were part of a family, it could go through the father, but you weren't actually Jewish. It was everybody got to pick until Sinai. Once we got the Torah, there was no more choice involved. If you're born in it, you were in it. So, and there's no exit door. But I'm not sure. I have also...
So it was after, because no one was really Jewish before Sinai.
Right.
So I was told specifically Judaism used to be part of
I'm not aware of that, but it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. It just means maybe my awareness is limited, but I'm not aware of that. So are you aware of anything like that? I'm just going to try to Google it and see, or text your husband. Good. We'll ask the rabbi.
Yeah.
Well, I think some of them converted, like Machlon and Kilion. Where what? Okay. Okay, yeah.
Also, you're talking about families in Shemla and the difference between Jewish and non-Jewish, but many families nowadays.
People want you to go right. There.
Want to. Let me just finish your question first. Yeah, go on.
So if you have a family like most Jewish modern families that have a lot of non-Jews in them as well, so if you're talking about a family neshama, how does that work?
I think that it complicates it quite a bit, frankly. And I think that the family neshama would be in the Jewish members, but I think it definitely complicates matters as to how the neshama can finish its route. It's very complicated. That being said, it's why do we have so many people converting today? So I converted when I was 16. I became interested in Judaism at 14. When I converted 31 years ago, yes, I'm 47, 31 years ago, it was pretty rare for somebody to convert out of conviction. It wasn't so rare for people to convert to get married. You know, Rabbi Joseph Lookstein, Alav HaShalom, used to ask a convert, potential convert, if that person was converting to embrace Judaism or converting to embrace a Jew. Right? So at that time, there are plenty of conversions to embrace a Jew, not necessarily to embrace Judaism. And I guess I think it was more done at that time than it is now. Now there's a lot of converts. Almost every city that I travel to, and I travel probably every 3 weeks about. I try to travel like once a month, but whatever. It's sometimes a little bit more frequently. Almost every city I go to, if somebody knows I converted, they tell me, you know, in our city, we have a lot of converts. I'm like, really? In every city, there's a lot of converts. There's a lot of converts today. They're just all over the place because it's Erev Mashiach, right? Mashiach is coming very soon. And so it is supposed to be that all the nations of the world come under the wings of the Shekhinah, come under the divine presence in a special way, in a different way. Gentiles do not have to be Jewish to fulfill their mission. But there is a different role of leadership that the Jew has in helping to connect everybody, all humanity, to the divine. So, and all the nations are supposed to take part in that in some way. So since the nations aren't necessarily coming in, people from the nations are coming in. Because a convert from Mexico is different than a convert from England, is different than a convert from Canada, is different than a convert from Congo, is different than a convert from Syria. They all bring a different energy into the Jewish people. And the Jewish people is a people of the world, really. We're supposed to lead the whole world into a relationship with the divine. That's our role, right? We're supposed to be an Or LaGoyim. Right? An Or being something that you see, not something that you hear. We're not supposed to be preaching on the streets, you know, the end is coming, convert soon. That's not our job. Our job is to behave so gorgeously that people look at us and say, wow, what makes you like that? What makes you so beautiful as an individual? What makes your marriage like that? What makes your family like that? What makes your community like that? What makes your businesses so honest and your people so kind and your government so functional, right? It should only happen soon. That's supposed to be the question. Everybody's supposed to look at us and say, wow, whatever you have, I want a piece of that. Teach it to me, please. Right? That's what it's supposed to be, is that they come to us. So we haven't yet achieved that. We're still working on that. But that is the Jewish plan. That's the Torah plan for us to attract the nations to us. But we are attracting. Even if we're not necessarily behaving in consonance with our mission yet, still people are attracted. So who are those people that are attracted? So we know that there's a Midrash. The Midrash tells a story of when the Torah was offered to the Jewish people, that Hashem went to the different nations and said, would you like the Torah? And they said, what's in it? And said, it says, don't steal. Oh, forget it, the Bedouins said. We love stealing, right? So, and then he brought it to the Ishmaelites, right? And they said, what's in it? So it says, don't steal, don't kill. And they said, oh, forget it. We love killing, right? And brought it to a few different nations, and they all rejected it because it had something in it they didn't like. When he brought it to the Jews said, na'aseh v'nishma. We will do, and we will hear. Yes, we'll take it. Now tell us about it, right? So that's what we said. But did Hashem really gather all the nations to ask that question? Did he bring all the people from each nation together and offer it to them, and they raised their hand and asked questions about it? That's not what happened, right? He really asked the energetic force of that nation, whatever you want to call that energetic force, whether you call that a malach, an angel, or a koach, whatever it is. But it was a conversation, so to speak, and it wasn't a direct conversation, but it was a recognition by the energy of that nation that the energy of that nation doesn't work with the Torah, not interested. But there were still individuals in that nation who were interested. So that's source number one for converts. Hashem said, do you want the Torah? The nation said no, but somebody in the back row said, I do. And that person had to go through history and do whatever they had to do to eventually join the Jewish people. That's one source of converts. Another is people who converted out for whatever reason or left for whatever reason. In whatever way it happened, whether they were kidnapped at birth or made a wrong decision in their life or whatever it is, people who need to come back in. So it could be reincarnations who are rectifying something in their soul history. Or they just happen to be the energetic bearers of something that needs to be brought into the Jewish people to strengthen the Jewish people. So the Jewish people have lots of different energies, and converts have come in at different times and brought different things. When Ruth converted, she brought vitamin chesed into the nation. We had a chesed deficiency, right? And so she brought that in to strengthen the nation with chesed. And it's interesting to see the different gerim. Rabbi Akiva comes from... Yeah, it's interesting to think about what happened to Abraham, right?
Yeah.
So Abraham made a lot of converts, right? Did you ever hear about them later?
I thought that was the Jewish people.
No.
No.
It's fascinating to think about. I think in the end, that's what happened. I mean, it says he made a lot of converts, but what happened to them? Right, it's a really good question. So. You're right. There's a lot of different things about that, right? So one is that maybe he just created nefeshot, that every time a husband and wife are intimate, it brings a neshama into the world, and that could be those nefeshot that they created. That's one possibility. But it's really more thought about that they actually converted people. They actually told people the system, and they bought into it. What system? So it wasn't a book of Torah, but there was Torah understandings. So how does that work? Well, it was more than that.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Believe in God.
No, it was more than that. It was more than that. It was more of a system of Torah. It wasn't a full system of Torah, but how is it that we say our forefathers kept large chunks of the Torah, but they didn't have the Torah, and we don't see in Bereishit, we don't see a recording in the book of Genesis, we don't have recorded the laws they're supposed to be keeping. How did they keep the laws? So just parenthetically, quickly, we do understand that the Torah is the blueprint of the world. So any astute architect could sit in the middle of this room, walk around the house, and draw up blueprints for the house, right? You could rebuild this house across the street if you wanted to, because an architect could derive the blueprint from the house. And then that blueprint could cause a house just like this to be built across the street. So a spiritually astute person can derive not all of, but much of the blueprint of the world from looking at the world. What that spiritually astute person can't get is what's inside. Just like that architect doesn't know what's inside the walls, doesn't know, is there Wi-Fi here or not? What do the pipes look like? How the electricity, what does it look like inside? That's Kabbalah, what's inside. That which you cannot derive from observation on any level has to be given to you as information. But the same thing with Torah. You can look at the world and derive quite a bit of it. So he did look at the world and derive quite a bit of it. And that's what he was teaching. But it wasn't enough. to create the critical mass of people who would be ready to change the world.
That was never the purpose.
Pardon?
That was never the purpose.
To change the world?
No, he changed the world because he brought in monotheism. But it was never his mission to build a new group of people.
Right, it wasn't. Right, right. Right. Monotheism was there before. There was monotheism before Abraham. Monotheism was not his contribution. He's called the first monotheist, but he was not the first monotheist. Adam was the first monotheist. Noah was a monotheist, and there are a bunch of monotheists in between. He was the first monotheist with a mission. Right? The first monotheist who got it in his kishkas so deep that he knew that this means there's something to do about it. Not just believe it, but you have to behave because of it. And that's what he was teaching. How do you behave because of this concept? So he's the first monotheist with a mission. And it is the role of the Jew to transform the planet. But you're right, it wasn't his role, which is why we are not called the B'nai Avraham. Right? Even though he's our first forefather. We're not B'nai Avraham. He's Avraham HaIvri, meaning he stands on the other side. Ivri is other side of the Jordan River, but he couldn't be named after the other side of the Jordan River. And he's named after the other side of the opinions of the whole world. Right? So the first name of the Jew, Ivri, is they stand on the other side of all the world's opinions. They stand alone. So that's the koach, the strength of Abraham and Sarah, is the ability to stand apart. But that's not enough to be Jewish. Right? But that ability to stand apart is why a convert to Judaism who stood apart from their family, stood apart from their nation, stood apart from what they were taught, and steps into the Jewish people is called Bat Avraham or Sarah. Right? I told my kids they don't have to say Sarah Imenu, they can say Sarah Safteinu. Right? Not our foremother, but our foregrandmother. Right? She's Sarah Safteinu for them. And my kids who wanted to have frum cousins, they always missed having observant cousins, so they created a cousins club. Right? So cousins are people who share grandparents. Right? That's what cousins are. So they decide anybody who has the grandparents, same grandparents as them, Sarah and Avraham, they must be their cousins. So that's the cousins club. So that way they have from cousins. All right. So So let me just tell you about the names of a Jew, because it's an interesting thing to think about. And this is also the progress of a conversion of a Jew. So the first thing is to stand apart. That's Ivri. But it's not enough to know what you're not. That's not what transforms the world, but that is what starts a personal transformation. You also have to know what you are, right? And that's the second name of the Jew, which is Jew, Yehudi, right? Jew is a transliteration, not a translation. Really, if you would translate Yehudi, what would we be called?
Thankful.
Thankful. Thankers, right? Yehudim, thankers, right? So we would be called the thankers. Right? The thankers or the admitters. Lehodot is to thank and to admit. So the acknowledgers, that acknowledges better than admit. Thank you. The acknowledgers, the thankers, right? So we're the thankers. So we know we're not that, Ivri, and we know what we are. We stand for acknowledgement that Hashem runs the world, and we're thankful for that. So we know what we stand for. But still, we're not called the B'nai Yitzchak, you know, and the B'nai Avraham. We have to know who we aren't, what we are, but also who we stand with. We have to be part of a group. There's a critical mass that gets this message into the psyche of the world, and that's why we're the B'nai Yisrael, right? That's the group that we're a part of. So we can't stand apart from our group. Sometimes we have to stand alone inside our group. That happens occasionally, but we do need to draw on that strength, but we have to know we are part of one neshama, one nation, one purpose. We stand with, it's one Klal Yisrael, one people of Israel, and as a critical mass, we can transform the world. And the last name of the Jew, extra credit for anybody who gets it. Ivri, Yehudi, Yisrael, Yeshurun. Good for you. I'm telling you, not many people get it. Yeshurun. Yeshurun is only mentioned three times in the Tanakh, the whole Tanakh. And Yeshurun, the root is Yeshar.
Straight.
That's how we do it. So what we're not, what we are, who we stand with, how we do it. Through Yashrus, straight. We have to be straight, right? It says in the psalm that we say on the Sabbath, Tzadik katamar yifrach, the righteous flourishes like the palm tree, right? So I was in California looking at palm trees, your home state, right? Looking at the palm trees thinking, gosh, look at them. They're straight, right? The righteous flourish like that, straight up with no diversions, right? Right. So there's a big difference between arrows and a palm tree. So a palm tree is straight. Maybe arrows is too. They're very straight, right? I've seen cedars, right, that are tall and straight, but what they're not is flexible, right? A palm tree, if you ever see pictures of storms, tropical storms or hurricanes, they bend right over, but they don't break, right? And then they come back, right? They're very resilient. And I just learned at the AJAP conference this year that palm trees, in order for dates to be sweet, really marketable, they're probably edible without this, but marketable, they have to grow in community. The roots have to touch. So a tzaddik also, a tzaddik blossoms like a palm tree in community, flexible and directed, right? And that's yeshar, right? That's what we need, is to be yeshar like that, right? Strong and flexible, like the lamed, right? That's a good teacher, hopefully, is like the letter lamed, the only letter that bends all the way backwards to accommodate somebody else. And then stand straight up at other times, right? So it's an important lesson to learn from the Lamed, how you could be so flexible in where you take a position sometimes. So I think we should end there. Do you want any other? I think that's enough information. If you have any questions, I'll answer questions.
So we finished the
Golden Shema? I think it's enough for tonight, yeah.
We need to clarify.
Yeah, let's clarify. There's of course, always more to learn about souls. But the main, so let's just review, okay? So five parts of the soul called the neshama. It's connected to the nefesh, connected to the blood in the body. The purpose of it being connected to the body is so that we can use the body as a tool to transform the soul. So we enter the physical in order to transform the spiritual. That transformation process is completely up to us. However we behave is how we transform our soul. Souls are much more complicated than we ever thought they were. That's another take-home message for tonight. I don't know enough to tell you. I know the tip of the iceberg. I taught you the tip of the iceberg. You pretty much exhausted my soul knowledge. Maybe I know a drop more, but not a lot, right? So that's what there is to know about souls. They're very complicated, but what's simple about them is we are in control. We get to, as complicated as it is, how we behave physically is how we transform ourselves spiritually. It's completely up to us. What we want to do, what we engage in, what we refrain from, that's how we're going to grow our soul. Ultimately, we shed the body and the soul is left over. And that's what we want to have. That's forever. So we want to use the opportunity that we have here to grow our souls as much as possible. And I think next month's talk will be fascinating about how to use challenge to grow our souls, right? That's the whole point. Custom design soul workshops, right? How do we grow our soul so that it comes out differently? Yeah? Any questions? Okay, great.